myself and the Inquirer, Dennis Prager, and this is Religion on the Line. In this program, we have a panel of clergy, and we invite you to call and address them with any questions that you may have, comments you may have on religion. And the panel tonight, do we have a fourth member? Do we have a fourth panel member? Okay. I guess we have four. I only thought we had three. We have a fourth member joining us. We'll get to him in just a second. I'm going to introduce the other three members first, anyway. And first is Father Gregory Quiro of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, Office of Public Affairs. And Pastor Greg Bonson of the Southern California Center for Christian Studies in Irvine, a Presbyterian minister. Rabbi Aaron Kriegel, Conservative Congregation Adat Shorashim in Reseda. And I haven't had time to meet our new fourth panelist yet. So would you introduce yourself? Get the microphone for him here, please. Okay, go ahead.
I'm from the Greater Community Baptist Church in Pacoima, first vice president of Western Baptist State Convention.
Okay, now the first name is what?
Dudley D.
Dudley, Pastor Chapman?
Right.
And I'm going to write down that was
First vice president.
First vice president of
Western State Baptist Convention.
Okay, we'll introduce you that way. All right, now that we are a little bit disorganized, we got everything cleared up, we're ready to take calls. 1-800-222-KABC is the telephone number. 1-800-222-5222. Panel of four clergy tonight, and let's go right to the phones. Hello, Dave in Long Beach. You're leading off.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
I'm going to let you on the line. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. What I'm calling about is with the news, Magic Johnson this week, him being HIV positive, how it relates to Religion on the Line is that the Catholic Church has taught that even married couples, if one person is HIV positive, they cannot use condoms. And that would go for Magic Johnson, that the Catholic Church would not allow him to use a condom to have sex with his wife. And I think that Cardinal Mahoney was on the Catholic Bishops Commission that made that ruling. It was actually a couple in New York City that asked for permission to use condoms, and the Catholic Church refused to give it to them. And I think that the Church is giving a number of people death sentences by their archaic position on condom use.
Okay, I think that one is headed for Father Gregory.
I think so also. Let me just say that when I heard the news about Magic Johnson, two things about it really saddened me. The first is obviously that the man has been infected with this virus, which could lead to a fatal illness. The second thing, though, that saddened me was to hear Magic Johnson say that he was going to jump on the so-called safe sex bandwagon. Safe sex, as it's being bandied about today, is really something of a myth. I really wish he'd waited a few weeks, perhaps, and maybe done a little bit of reflection and some discussion with his wife. And if indeed being HIV positive and he and his wife were engaging in sexual relations, I think it would have been very interesting to hear how safe either one of them really felt. Because we know that condoms break. We know that they're not 100% reliable. They don't eliminate the risk of spreading disease. They can reduce it. And I just wonder if it's really apropos for Magic Johnson to be given the hero status he's been given now, because he's going to go around telling young people to practice what he calls safe sex. We know that with HIV, the only sure way to prevent the spread of the virus is through abstinence. That's the only 100% way to prevent the spread of the disease.
But you see, Father, there's people that are married where one person is HIV positive, and Magic Johnson's wife is negative right now. If he follows the Catholic Church's teachings, that means that he would not use a condom, and that means that is much more dangerous than somebody using a condom. And I cannot believe you can sit there and try to defend the Catholic Church's teaching on this when it is just like an ostrich putting his head in the sand. And Cardinal Mahoney, I think, is the worst one. And I cannot believe...
Well, I don't understand, you know...
saying the things you are. How can you do that?
You know...
And the Cardinal. I cannot believe it.
Okay, now listen.
I'm sorry.
This is not...
I understand why I'm upset about this, though.
You know, this is not the only disease or condition which can preclude couples having sexual relations. Many times when a member of a married couple becomes ill...
Listen, Dave, let Father Gregory talk. Yeah.
Sexual relations become either impossible or unadvisable. And while certainly that is a loss, which, you know, no one is gleeful about, it's something to mourn. The fact is that it is a fact of life, that there are diseases whereby people are no longer able to have sexual relations.
Right. Father, if you were counseling, say, Magic and his wife right now, what would you counsel them? Would you counsel them to abstain?
I would ask them to consider that if they are going to be continue to have the sexual relationship, which is a part of any marriage, to consider that every time it's going to be, you know, very risky. And and even if they were to use condoms, I would still say that's going to be risky, but I would not counsel them to use condoms. I would counsel them to try to transcend and see what other ways there are for them to express their love and their appreciation for each other and their union. And, you know, if they do engage in sexual relations, to realize that each time that they're going to be putting her health at risk, because up to now, anyway, she tests negative.
Mm-hmm. It might be valuable. This is This is Dr. Bonson from the Southern California Center for Christian Studies. I think to just take for granted the Roman Catholic position about condoms, and then to have the caller concerned about the consequences of that, is not going to lead to a satisfactory discussion of this, because if the Roman Catholic position is correct, morally correct, then we would all have to say the consequences are going to have to be accepted. Let the chips fall where they may. If that's what God has commanded, then that's the way it's going to be. But it is legitimate, I think, to ask why the Roman Catholic Church would teach that from a Protestant perspective. If we can just, you know, get a different look at this question, we would approach questions of ethics from the standpoint of the authority of God's Word and it alone being allowed to dictate what we do or not do. And from that reformed or reformational position, we would find it hard to understand why the Roman Catholic Church says that. So maybe it would be helpful if you explain to our hearers why you take that position.
Okay, well, first of all, I think people should know that up until about 35, 40 years ago, all major Christian denominations were opposed to artificial contraception. It wasn't just the Roman Catholic Church and the Greek Orthodox Church.
That's not really quite accurate. There were questions among many Protestant denominations about contraception, but there has been no official position taken against it in the Presbyterian Church.
Well, but all I'm saying is that, you know, up until, you know, some time ago, there was opposition coming from Protestant circles as well as Catholic and Orthodox circles. Our stance is very clearly based upon the understanding of the natural law. Sexual intercourse is geared towards, it's ordered towards two purposes. One is the procreation of children. The other one is expressing the union between husband and wife. And in order for sexual intercourse to be a truly human act, it would have to have its integrity respected. And therefore, both those ends, procreation and the possibility of procreation, and the union between husband and wife would have to be respected. We would say it was sinful if a husband forced himself upon his wife, and it was not an expression of love and union, but rather an expression of power and dominance. We would say that would be a sin. So too, any act of sexual intercourse that takes place without at least being open to the possibility of the transmission of new life would also be sinful.
Yeah, there's a lot about natural law, philosophy, and ethics in our society these days with the Clarence Thomas hearings and so forth. Let me throw in a Protestant perspective and see if this comes anywhere close to what you could agree with. We read in the Bible of the creation of man and woman, and of course God providing the first wife. And it would appear from the biblical presentation that the first reason Adam needed a wife was because of his loneliness. There is no appropriate partner for him. And after the creation of Eve, we of course do have the command given for the propagation of the human race. If you took a biblical rather than a natural law approach, then you would say that sex has its appropriate use in the love and affection between a man and a woman, even apart from being used to, or being open to, as you put it, it being a childbearing act. If we took a natural law approach to things, I remember Niebuhr once said that man is the only animal that's always in heat. And if we're going to look for what is natural to man, then if we took that more or less Aristotelian approach, we might draw the conclusion that man's proper end is always to be engaging in sex. it's hard to look at the natural world and to draw ethical conclusions, don't you think? I mean, the sorts of things we see in the natural world, the violence, the promiscuity among animals and so forth.
Well, I don't think I would say that as much, Pastor, as I would say that it is possible to see God's will expressed in the natural order of things.
All right. This has gotten quite deep here. It hasn't, however, answered Dave's original anger.
Right.
But, Dave, I don't know.
I suspect that unless the Catholic Church ceases to be Catholic, Dave is going to be unhappy.
No, that's not true. I think you have to be responsible.
I think the Catholic Church is very responsible. I think people like Magic Johnson and those who are telling young people to use condoms are being irresponsible.
You're killing people, Father.
No, I'm not killing anybody. The Catholic Church isn't killing anybody, Dave. It's people who refuse to accept that there are consequences for people's moral behavior.
And there is for your teaching, and that is people will not use condoms to engage in unsafe sex, and they will get AIDS. And you give it the church's blessing.
Dave, I think you're being terribly unrealistic. People,
I think you're being unrealistic.
People who are concerned about the church's teaching about condoms are not the least bit concerned about, who are not concerned with the church's teaching about condoms, are not the least bit concerned with the church's teaching on chastity. The Catholic Church teaches that every human being must live according to the virtue of chastity.
For permission to use condoms, and the church has said no. Under no circumstances can people use condoms. How can you say Johnson and his wife can not use condoms?
Dave, the church can say that. The other answer to that is, of course, that you can go ahead and disregard the church's teaching if you will take that.
Which is the way most people are contracting the AIDS virus anyway, is that they're not regarding the church's teaching.
Okay, I don't see that there's any way we're going to come to an agreement here.
Okay, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ira.
This is Talk Radio 790 KABC. You're listening to Religion on the Line. I'm Ira Fistel, filling in tonight for Dennis Prager. And our panel includes four members of the clergy. Pastor Dudley Chapman, first vice president of the Western States Baptist Convention, who hasn't had a chance to say a word yet.
Glad to be here.
Rabbi Aaron Kriegel, conservative congregation of Adat Shor HaShem in Mesita. He hasn't had a chance to say a word yet. Father Gregory Quiro of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles Office of Public Affairs, and Dr. Greg Bronson, Presbyterian Minister of Southern California Center for Christian Studies. And they have had a chance to say quite a few words already. Now let's go to our next call. Line 15, hello, Winston and Whittier.
Howdy.
Hi there.
Yeah, when Dennis was on, he talked a great deal, I'm sure you heard, about the new kind of religion of that denies of the Judeo-Christian God in favor of this or that. I was just at Santa Monica College this Thursday in Tom Hayden's class. I dropped in on it.
I didn't know he had one.
Well, he's teaching at Santa Monica College. He's teaching a thing, I think it's called Environment and Spirituality, in which, now he's very cagey. He was the night I was there because there was a big article in the L.A. Times. Let me see, it was, I got the date here.
Pardon me.
I don't know. It was about a month ago, and then there was a letter to the editor, 10/27/91, saying that if he's allowed to teach New Age religion in order to get people to go along with his environmental program, why can't Christians teach their programs in public schools? So naturally, I wanted to go in and see what was going on, so I called up his partner, Dave Phillips, and he said, yeah, come on in. Well, Hayden wouldn't answer my questions. I think he was suspicious. But at the same time, as cagey as he was, what he's doing is he's teaching that we should return to the concept of Gaia, which he says is the Greek goddess of Earth.
Yeah, Gaia, yeah.
Gaia, Gaia.
Gaia Stella, yes, I know.
And he says that the Christian Judaic God, Jehovah, the whole concept is erroneous. It gives man dominion over the animals, and that really man is the destructive force right now, and that we should sacrifice our own good for the good of the ecosystem. Now, see, when these demigods get going, they do about 80% truth, and then they throw in the rest of it. But what we've got is a guy teaching a public school what basically is pagan religion.
Okay, your problem is that it's a public school.
Yeah,
because he certainly has a right to believe anything he wants to believe.
Oh, absolutely, and teach it. But he's teaching it on public property. He's got the president of the college, according to the newspaper article, backs him 100% on this. And my feeling is that what he's doing is he's taking away from the moral God and giving to it's almost a socialistic God. He wants the animals to sacrifice.
Okay, but that's not the point. The legitimate point you make is the question of whether this is religion in the public schools, which is the real issue.
Well, he and this other guy are now denying that, but what they do is through the process of the videos they show and the readings they give, it sets it up so the only conclusion you can come to is that Jehovah is a fraud for saying man has dominion.
Fine, they can say that if they want, but that's not the issue. What they say, it's where they say it becomes. Now, the question I want to take up here is with the clergy. Anyone want to comment on this?
Well, I would imagine
Pastor Johnson. Yeah,
I would imagine that the way it will be defended is that this is not religious teaching because it does not have some kind of liturgy. Some kind of house of worship or something of that nature that goes along with it. And
about college level here. We're not talking about grade school. So the preceptor is somewhat different. The receptor
That's
is
true.
Somewhat different.
That's true. But you see, I think we have in our public debates all the time the equivocation on this word religion. We say, well, that's not religious because we don't have a sect or a creed or something like that, whereas religion can also encompass the sorts of philosophical ultimate convictions that the caller is concerned about being propagated.
Rabbi Kriegel, if you don't mind, I'd like to answer a question that you mentioned about Tom Hayden's theology. I didn't hear Tom Hayden, and I don't know if he said this, but I'd like to say about the Bible, whether for Christian or for Jew, that God's mandate to man in the first chapter of Genesis, the first chapter of the Bible, whether it's for Jews or Christians or Muslims, is that man has dominion over the animals. That's true. But God also says that both for man and animals, our food will be from the from seed-bearing trees, that we're not made to kill animals. And it seems like the first ecological mandate that was ever made any place is found in that first chapter in the Bible, where man is commanded to make sure that everything can live well and not to kill any animals. So if that was the premise that he was working under, I think it's a wrong premise.
May I? I was just reading Deuteronomy today, and it explains that man may eat all animals except those that have the cloven hoof that do not chew the cud.
Oh, they got that backwards, don't you?
I'm not going to go into it a little backwards. But if you look at Noah, that comes after the first chapter in Genesis. God says that he sees that the impulse, inclination of man is evil from his youth. And at that time, God makes a compromise and says that I can see that you're not going to be vegetarians as I would have liked to see you in a perfect world. But God sets up special rules so that people can eat meat, not all meat, but some meat, without taking advantage of the animal kingdom. And the laws that you find in Leviticus and in Deuteronomy are laws that just expand on that and are particular to the Jewish people. But the first concepts of Adam living in a, or the first creation, man living in a vegetarian world is for all humanity. And the second idea of Noah, eating meat in a limited way, is also meant for all humanity.
Well, but Adam and Eve ran around naked. I mean, that was a different time, was it not?
Well, wait a minute. They only ran around naked until they found out that they ate from the tree of knowledge and found out they were naked.
That might be true, but
the
first chapter of Genesis isn't about Adam and Eve. They're found in the second creation story, which begins in chapter 2, verse 4.
But what we're really asking is, what doesn't apply anymore? Winston, you just said something didn't apply anymore.
I'm saying that it seems to me that the Bible is very clear that man is a meat-eating animal and that he's permitted to eat a great variety of fish, fowl, and red meat.
A small variety.
All right. But is this inconsistent with a kind of a balance between man and nature? And I think the rabbi's point is that there's very clearly in the biblical script, in the scriptures, a balance established between man and nature, in which man, while he may use nature, may not abuse nature.
And anybody with any sense would agree with that. What I'm saying is that most of what Hayden is teaching is just common sense. It's nothing new. My point is that he seems to be condemning. The traditional religion and promoting a new age religion.
Okay, now next we have a comment from Pastor Chapman.
Did you say this is being taught on the college campus?
That is correct.
Well, I would have a little confidence in the college student Because paganism has been taught on the college campus ever since there's been college campuses, and the religions that are real have still survived. I would have a little confidence in the college student. Even in college, sometimes we accept some things that that we think are crazy after we get out. But when we get out of college, we seem to somehow come to the reality and religion that is right and has a good foundation finds its way in the life of the society. So I would just have more confidence in the student.
Just not worry about it.
Yeah, I wouldn't be as concerned on a college campus because you're there to learn about, you're there seeking knowledge and knowledge of what Hayden has to say and what the Greeks had to say and what whoever had to say. I wouldn't worry as much there as I would in other circumstances.
Okay. Winston, thank you very much.
Okie doke.
Appreciate your call. It still seems to me that the real issue here is the issue of whether this violates the idea of religion in public schools. I don't know that it does, especially because we're talking about college rather than a...
Well, it would if, of course, we hold out for equality of treatment of all religious faiths or non-religions. Yeah. And it turns out that a Christian could not teach from his unique point of view.
Yeah. Which is what,
right, would be
what
a problem.
Bothers me about this,
right.
So whether there's an issue there. But as far as the content of the thing, I mean, Tom Hayden can say, you know, the fish in the seas are God, and or he can say that the ants on the ground, or he can say anything he wants, as far as that's concerned. And what he believes is not necessarily what anybody else wants to believe. So to our next call here on Religion on the Line, Kathy in Mission Viejo, you're on the air with the panel.
Yeah, I had a question for the rabbi. I thought at one time I had heard Dennis Prager say that he did not believe that there was a devil and that the Jews did not believe there was a devil. I was wondering if that's true.
Well, Jews don't believe in the devil. At best, you can say we believe in something called the Sitra Achra. Sitra Achra stands for the other side, and that's the absence of God. So where God isn't, evil can be, but evil doesn't have any persona, and evil can't speak. Evil is something that man has to make a choice to do in disobeying God's word.
Okay, is Job a part of the Hebrew?
Right, and the Jewish people believe, it's found in our Talmud, that Job is a fictitious story that was written by the man who knew God best, by Moses. So we never took Job to be a true story, and consequently we don't take the people who are found in the book of Job to be people who really lived.
However, the book of Job was accepted as canonical by the Jews, the Council of Jamnia, and so forth.
Just as the book of Job has something very important to teach about evil, just as the first chapter in Genesis, with all its bad science, is something very important to teach about humanity and ecology. And I think we can learn from books, whether they're true or books of fiction, even if every word in those books isn't true.
So the book of Job, you believed, was not was just fictitious characters and a story to...
I believe, as the Talmud says, that the book of Job was written by Moses to answer questions that Moses had about good and evil in the world.
Okay.
So the answer to your question is, Kathy, no, most Jews do not, or I guess Jews in general, do not believe in the devil in the Christian sense.
Right. Right.
They do believe, however, that there is such a thing as evil in the world.
Okay.
Correct. Okay?
Okay, thanks.
Right. It's the personification of evil that is not accepted, right?
However, it again, in the Old Testament, it's beyond the book of Job, an evil personage is presented, and if you want to interpret that as a personification, then that, of course, is something you can debate, but I don't think we can dismiss so quickly that the Old Testament presents it that way. And we have, in the case of the story of King Ahab, and certainly in the Garden of Eden and so forth, a personal representation of evil and not just a personification.
Okay, but not the personification that Christians are familiar with, you know, Satan and his many manifestations.
What is the distinction when you say not the manifestation?
Because maybe I'm getting out of my water. I mean, I may need the rabbi to back me up here, but it seems to me that when you talk about evil as personified by the serpent in the garden, it's not, the serpent is not the devil. serpent is simply being used at this point to make
the
point.
Oh, yes. Yeah. But you see, that's different from the literary technique of personification. If you take the story literally,
then we're talking
you have an evil spirit that uses the body of a snake to speak. Or
thank goodness, we're talking across purposes.
But, you have to read into the text to find that. We don't believe in reading into the text in order to do those things with the text and create figures out of it.
I don't know. I think if you read the Talmud, you'd find a lot of reading into the text as well. Everyone does interpretation.
I'm ready to be challenged.
Okay, good.
I'm ready to bow out of this and go to a next call. This is KABC, and you're listening to Religion on the Line. I'm Ira Fistel, filling in for Dennis Prager tonight. Our panel includes Dr. Greg Bonson, Southern California Center for Christian Studies in Irvine, a Presbyterian minister, Father Gregory Quiro of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, Roman Catholic priest, Rabbi Aaron Kriegel, conservative congregation Adat Shor Hashim in Reseda, and Pastor Dudley Chapman, first vice president of the Washington State Baptist Convention. A four-man panel tonight. Let's go to our next call on KABC. Ron, you're on the air on Religion on the Line.
Hi, everybody. I wanted to ask Father Gregory a question. I'm Catholic, and I tend to lean toward being an evangelical Catholic. I have, you know, some evangelical Christian friends that I work with and some pro-life things. I also enjoy listening to evangelical Christian radio stations and find myself agreeing with them a lot, although I don't always agree with a lot of their feelings about the Catholic Church. One of the things that I would ask Father what the Catholic Church might be doing about, if anything, is abuses of veneration of Mary. I think this tends to be a real good dividing point between Catholics and Protestants, especially like evangelicals. And
what would you consider to be abusive?
Well, for instance, a couple months ago, it was reported on the news on a Christian, evangelical Christian station. They interviewed a nun from Santa Ana. Apparently, there was a Catholic school down there where a life-size statue of Mary was stolen. And they interviewed the nun, and she was all upset. And she said she never referred to the statue as it. She referred to it as she, and said that the statue was also responsible for many conversions, and that they have taught the grade school children hymns to the statue. And also a point that one of the hosts on one of these stations brought up is when he was in Rome, there was a statue in a church there where the eyes, nose, mouth, and even the nipples on the breast of the statue of Mary were all worn off from people, you know, just rubbing it and kissing it, you know, and, you know, those types of things. And I was just wondering if when these types of things happen, especially if it's a nun, you know, or somebody in that position, if the church ever speaks out to the clergy and the lay people about, you know, it's like, you know, pray to Mary or whatever, but let's watch how far we go with it.
May I ask you one question before I give this to Father? And that is, do you consider these things abuses?
Yes.
You do. Okay. Father?
Okay, well, first of all, there have been times when Marian devotion, as well as devotion to the other saints, have been exaggerated, and that's something which should be avoided. Veneration of the saints is something which goes, you know, to the very earliest days of Christian experience, when the early Christians venerated at the tombs of the martyrs, those who had given up their lives for the faith. It can be exaggerated if we cross the line from, and I have to use here some technical language, from dulia and hyperdulia into latria. Latria is praise and adoration which is given to God alone. Dulia is veneration given to Christian heroes, the saints, and hyperdulia is the veneration given to Mary, the Mother of God. I would say if the sister expressed herself in calling the statue she, it was probably more out of affection for that particular statue and what it represented rather than any kind of idolatry or, you know, giving to the statue something which would belong only to God.
Well, I could almost...
people should not pray to statues, and oftentimes Catholics are accused of praying to statues, and we don't. We are invoking the people who the statue represents. And we venerate the statues themselves it's a more of a symbolic thing. Say, for example, in St. Peter's Basilica, there's an ancient statue of St. Peter whose foot is worn bare from people kissing it. But that's a symbolic action. It's not saying we worship the statue. What it's saying is that we're venerating St. Peter and the role that Christ gave him when he appointed him the first pope. But those things can be very easily confused, and sometimes people with simple minds cause the most confusion.
I think that some of their points, you know, on Christian radio or so would be, well, the Catholic Church says all the right things. They say, well, we don't worship it. We just venerate it, and, you know, we should never put veneration of Mary on the same par with Christ or anything. But their attitude is, well, you know, you have the statues, you pray in front of the statues, you have hymns to Mary, you have processions to Mary, and it's kind of like, if it looks like a duck, it walks like a duck, it quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. And
no, that's not true.
You know,
that's not true, because it, like I say, it goes very early into our Christian tradition of venerating the saints.
I think it's important for Protestants to understand that this is not just some concoction of the Catholic Church either. I mean, I have, you know, tons of Catholic apologetics books here, and I mean, some of the earliest prayers to Mary go back to the year 303 with the early church martyrs under Diocletian, where they prayed, you know, for Mary to help them and protect them. And of course, if the evangelical claim that the Catholic Church didn't even start until the 4th century were true, if they were right about that, then this would just go to show that these at least were not Catholics, you know, these early church martyrs, you know, who are actually praying to her. And also, even Luther and Calvin themselves believed that it was okay to pray to Mary and saints.
That is absolutely mistaken.
Oh, I can read you a prayer right here that wrote to John Frederick.
Now, you pick up John Calvin's Institutes of the Christian Religion. He has an entire chapter in there on how we are not to venerate the saints, much less to pray to them. Now, he may be wrong, he may be right, but don't misrepresent. I mean, that's my tradition. Be real careful there. We do not believe in the veneration of saints.
Oh, boy,
but Luther, I'll have to take your word for it on Calvin, Pastor, but Luther definitely retained his devotion to Mary even after he left the Catholic Church.
Don't put Calvin in that list, then.
Well, okay. Ron, I don't know if we settled anything here, but we've discussed it. Let's have someone else have a chance.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
23 minutes before 11 o'clock, you're listening to Religion on the Line. I'm Ira Costello, filling in for Dennis Prager tonight with a panel of clergy. Our next caller is Todd in Los Angeles. Hi, Todd. You're on the air.
Good evening, Rabbi. How are you?
Hello.
Rabbi, what I wanted to talk about this evening is the David Duke situation for the gubernatorial candidate for the state of Louisiana. And before I get your comment, I just wanted to make a quick comment myself. I'm frightened to death about this man being in the position to represent the entire state of Louisiana, and I think it's absolutely ludicrous that he's in this position. And also, I just wanted to mention that I'm sure you're already aware of the situation. However, I just wanted to reiterate the fact that he didn't recognize the Holocaust. He's a former Nazi Ku Klux Klan member.
And we all know all those things.
Right, we all know that. And I just want to get your opinion about this unfortunate, traumatic, tragic situation that he's actually in the running.
It's a good question, Todd. I think there are clear parallels that one can draw between Hitler and between David Duke. However, I think we also have to recognize the differences in societies, and we have to recognize that we live in a pluralistic society, that David Duke hasn't yet won his election, and that there's a chance he might lose his election, and that even if he doesn't lose his election, we have political process in this country made up of many, many minority groups, whether they're black or Latino or Jewish or Christian,
yes,
that are going to fight hard in order to make sure that men of his ilk aren't going to raise to national office. I have faith in the American people that they'll do the right thing, and I have faith in the goodness of the American people that we'll be able to always form together and join a coalition in order to make sure that bigots of any corner of the world will be defeated.
Yes, now, one good thing that I wanted to mention is that President Bush, he's giving absolutely no support. He's not backing, endorsing by any means. He's not backing Mr. Duke. But furthermore, what's really frightening is I just got a report this evening that, unfortunately, Mr. Duke is receiving a lot of support at this time. Did you happen to hear about that?
I haven't heard the news.
Well, what support are you speaking of? What support are you speaking of?
Pardon me?
Todd, what support are you speaking of? You're talking about voters, you mean, in Louisiana?
From the people of the state.
From the voters, yeah.
From the voters.
Yeah, he probably will get somewhere upwards of 40% of the vote. I think that's a reasonable expectation. And that's a lot of votes.
I think voters change people also. I hope he doesn't win. But there was once a time when Strom Thurmond stood for everything that was wrong in society, and I'm not crazy about him right now,
oh, sir.
But he gets tremendous black support. in the state of South Carolina, and he helps the black community right now. And I think there's always been a fringe vote, whether it's made with people who support George Wallace or Strom Thurmond or David Duke, who will vote for those people. But I don't think that because they're allowed to run in our system, and fortunately we have a free system, that means that they're going to win every time or they're going to take over the power of government in the United States.
Right. What do you feel about, thank you, Rabbi, what do you feel about this, Ira?
Well, I'm going to be very brief about this. I think the candidacy of David Duke is simply one step further in the political expression of what might be called the white backlash in Louisiana. His rhetoric now is not different from almost any other candidate, conservative candidate you find. The difference is who's saying it. It's the same words, but it's a different source. And whether Duke wins or not, I do not think he's going to. Personally, I don't think he's going to win. But either way, I think it's an expression of hard times in Louisiana for one reason. I mean, the state has been depressed for 10 years.
Cool.
And I think that has a lot to do with it. A lot of the people who may be voting for David Duke may not understand what he stands for. If you saw the article in the LA Times about 2 weeks ago by the senior at LSU, who was writing that so many students at the school supported David Duke, not realizing, not having any idea of what his past was.
Well, the difficulty, of course, is in anyone figuring out what David Duke actually believes.
And what he says he believes now is not what he
said
he believed well. But,
and it's very hard to judge a man when he says he has turned from these convictions. He claims to be converted to Jesus mm-hmm. Christ now and so forth. That isn't to say that the political philosophy that he teaches even now, I'm not satisfied with as a Christian. But it's been such a short time since he's been known to make the outlandish kind of remarks that he has, that it's hard for anybody to really say where he's coming from. And I think that's the most difficult thing. If you knew very clearly that he believed this, that, and the other, you might have some kind of referendum that tells you what the people of Louisiana really believe about these matters. But it's just very ambiguous to me.
Yeah.
It seems to me, though, that one way of trying to make a judgment, and here I don't know whether he has done it or not, but if he's truly converted and changed his ways, he would repudiate. I mean, not just say, I've changed my ways, but repudiate the support of the people who still hold the views that he formerly held. And I don't know that he's done that.
I don't believe he has. No.
Well, not. Well,
that's Chapman.
I don't think... I can't envision him getting a strong black support.
Oh, he probably certainly won't.
I can't...
I mean, after all, this is a man who was, until a few years ago, the head of the Klan.
That's right.
I do not suspect that many black voters in Louisiana are going to vote for him.
Regardless of how good it sounds, or how good he makes it sound, I don't think that they would...
The same reason, I doubt that he's going to get many votes from Louisiana Jews, because, after all, he was also celebrating Hitler's birthday party until maybe three or 4 years ago. All right, let's go to our next call. Thank you very much.
Take
it. Just the mathematics of the thing, there are approximately, in the primary, which was a unilateral primary, there's no two parties, the current candidate, Edwards, the Democrat, got about 33% of the vote. Duke got, 34% for Edwards, 32% for Duke, and 27% for Romer, the incumbent governor, who is the regular Republican. The real question is, where will that 27% of the vote go? Romer's 27%. If about half of it goes for Duke and about half of it goes for Edwards, Edwards will win. If two-thirds of it goes for Duke, Duke has a very good chance of winning. And it really comes down to what will the regular Republican voters, the normal Republican voters of Louisiana, do.
Mm-hmm.
And every indication up till now seems to be that with Mr. Romer supporting Edwards and Mr. Bush supporting Edwards, that many of those Republican votes will indeed go to Edwards over Duke, and that Duke will not be elected. But you never know until Election Day, and that's, next Saturday, I believe. Let's go to our next call here. This is Religion on the Line. Tommaso in Studio City, you're on the air.
Thank you. Good evening, Ira and clergy. The situation in Louisiana, I just want to briefly say that it epitomizes the sad state of political candidates that where you just have to choose between the lesser of two evils.
Well, remember that there was a primary in which there were 16 people running, and these are the two who emerged from the primary with the most votes. That's why they're the two finalists, because that's who the people of Louisiana chose to be the two finalists.
It's incredible to me. My question focuses on the Dome of the Rock, place in Israel, I believe.
It's in Jerusalem.
Jerusalem. I wanted to ask what religious significance, if any, historical religious significance, that place has in the Jewish, Christian, and Muslim faith.
Well, unfortunately, we don't have anybody from the Islamic Center here tonight, but we do have Jews and Christians, so... Rabbi, start with Rabbi Kriegel first.
For the Jews, the Dome of the Rock doesn't have any special significance. However, the land it's on is where the temple was built. And most Jews who believe that another temple will be built there believe that God will build a temple, and for them it's just a place that we're not allowed to go to until the temple is built. Other Jews don't believe a temple will ever be built, and for those people will visit the Dome of the Rock, but have less significance for the holiness of the place. And there are some people who believe that we should build a temple actively, and for those people, the Dome of the Rock is a building that holds back the end of days, and the Dome of the Rock should be destroyed. I can say for Muslims, the Dome of the Rock is important because it's at the Dome of the Rock that I believe that Muhammad went up to heaven.
Right. As I understand it, though, there's also historical significance for the mount, because not only is it the site of the temple,
it's also
supposedly the site of the...
It's the site of many things. It's at the rock is where God created the world. At the rock is where Abraham sacrificed his son.
Or didn't, but it was going to. Yeah.
He
didn't actually sacrifice.
Oh, you're right, right, right. Correctly. Where he almost sacrificed his son. And there are many events that took place at that particular place. It's a place that people believe was the place where the world was created, and that's why if you look at old maps that think of the world as a flat plain, you'll find a little mountain going up, and it reaches its height in Jerusalem. Everything goes down from there because God started creating the world at the top of that mountain and built the rest of the world afterwards. So it has a significance, that place.
All right, now let's talk to Christian clergy. Anybody want to express, is there any special... Because, of course, the Holy Site in Jerusalem for Christians is
right.
The Church of the Holy Sepulchre.
Yeah, I'm not certain that we would attach any special spiritual significance to the Dome of the Rock, other than to be respectful of the significance it does hold for the Muslim community.
I think we want to clarify here that when we say the Dome of the Rock, you're actually referring to the mosque built over the rock.
Right.
The rock itself is Mount Moriah.
Right.
The Dome of the Rock is the mosque built over the rock. I believe it's considered the third holiest site in Islam, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. Apart from its historical significance, from a Protestant perspective, we don't attach spiritual importance to that as well. We remember how our Lord taught that one greater than the temple is here, and pointed to himself. He said, "Destroy this temple, I'll raise it in 3 days," referring to his own body. And so from that point on, it cannot have the kind of significance it would have had for what we would consider an Old Testament Jew and so forth. Apart from its history, we remember its importance.
Yes, we remember the history of it all, but religious significance would not that much given to it.
Okay, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does.
Thank you. All right. It's wonderful to get a question we can answer and say thank you, goodbye.
And leave with a satisfied customer.
1-800-222-KABC is the telephone number. This is Religion on the Line. I'm Ira Fistel filling in for Dennis Prager tonight. Once again, to run through the panel, Rabbi Aaron Kriegel of Conservative Congregation Adat Shor HaShem in Reseda, Jewish Rabbi Dudley Chapman, pastor and first vice president of the Western States Baptist Convention, Father Gregory Quiro of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, Roman Catholic priest, and Dr. Greg Bronson, Presbyterian minister at Southern California Center for Christian Studies in Irvine. And our next caller is Ron in Northridge. You're on the air on Religion on the Line, Ron.
Yes, good evening. My question is going to be addressed to all the members of the panel. And my question basically is whether they think there is a moral crisis in America. And I'm looking at an article I saw on the calendar section of the Times yesterday by Howard Rosenberg, an article. And it's called "What's Missing from the News of Johnson's Plight." And if I could read just two short paragraphs, it'll make clear what I'm referring to. It says, "Nowhere in secular TV did anyone urge kids not to have sex, or at least think about it more carefully."
Now, this question came up earlier tonight. I don't know if you heard.
Yeah. Okay. But then my question is, and I don't think I think it was directed mainly to the priest, but I'd like to hear all the members of the panel then basically, because I noticed in what's being recovered, for example, in the secular media is nobody wants to come out and say, for example, I know Quayle did. He said abstinence is what he thought would be the best thing, and in the news, somebody there challenged him and said, are you trying to say Magic Johnson shouldn't come out for what he... And he had to back off and say, well, I'm not saying that Magic isn't courageous or whatever and coming out, and he wasn't going to deny what Magic's approach to this whole issue was, but I think people are backing down in taking a firm stand for abstinence, and I think it's showing a real moral crisis myself in America. What does the panel think?
Right, who wants to tackle this one first? I think I'm going to give it to Pastor Chapman. Okay.
Magic was talking about safe sex, because basically there's no such thing when you're considering sex in regards to diseases of this magnitude. Like the priest, wished he had waited a little while before deciding how to approach the problem and who to stand for. I admire him for the way he came out and presented the whole problem he was having. How it affects our children and how it affects what we're going to do later, I think... is not going to be as big as people anticipate. I think that superstars don't dictate morals.
What do you think, the children will be more responsible, or do you think they're going to go along with the safe sex campaign, though?
I think the children are going to learn their morals the same way they learned them before. Good parents and good churches and good... I think the way morals will be affected the same way as they were affected before. This will have a great influence, but I don't think that it would be a serious thing to consider. Be it Magic Johnson, a human being like the rest of us, I feel really bad because it's happened to him. But it also shows, that itself shows that there's no safeness in the sex.
And that's true. I think parental influence is crucial. I want to agree with you there. But I don't think I would underestimate the influence that a man like Magic Johnson has on young people. They look up to him, they respect him, they look at his lifestyle, they long to be able to do the sorts of things he does and be the kind of person he is. And I agree with Father Gregory. I wish he had waited and instead of getting on the safe sex campaign, my own, you know, I have high regard for this man, for what he's accomplished and so forth. It was devastating, you know, for me to hear this news too. But I wish he had come out in favor of morally safe sex, you know, and if he'd
stopped... What does that mean?
Then, I think that means that you learn that sex, as ordained by God, is to be practiced only within marriage with your partner, and that is not only safe biologically, or for the most part, but that's safe morally, because then we don't have to deal with the human consequences of disobeying God's word, and above all, from my perspective, have to deal with God ultimately for not living as he has taught us to live.
The one good thing, man.
Yeah, Rabbi, go ahead.
Yes, hello.
Who's going to talk? Yeah. Pastor Chapman's going to talk.
The one good thing that happened from the Magic Johnson incident is that you have seen public prayer without prayer being publicly abused. It seemed to have been all right to see the teens hover around and pray.
Well, of course, it is perfectly all right because you're talking about a private institution. They can pray all they like, and you know, the difference is, of course, if it's a publicly financed thing, it's different. All right, now, Rabbi.
I don't think that.
Your microphone here.
I don't think that Magic Johnson has...
For some reason, your microphone isn't on.
Hello. Oh,
there you go. Now we got it.
I don't think that Magic Johnson has defined safe sex as the use of condoms. If he did, if he meant only that, he would have said, use condoms. I think that he's coming with all the authority he has, and certainly he has a lot of authority with his team and with the Boys and Girls of America, to say that we have to start living a different kind of life. And I wouldn't prejudge him and say that he did something too early. I think it took a lot of courage for him to stand up and say what he said and say it with the demeanor that he said it. And I think he recognizes, as we all recognize now, that there is a moral crisis, as Ron has pointed out, that there are no clear sexual mores in America, that there's no clear positions taken, whether it's on birth control or abortion or homosexuality or what consenting adults can do, or what children can do, or what children can do with adults, or what adults can do with children. We're trying to work those ideas out right now, and even though some of those ideas are very distasteful to some of us who are sitting here right now, we can't say we can walk on the streets of America and ask an American, what do you think is right about sex?
Mm.
I don't think anybody really knows. It's up to the religious establishment, I think, and it's up to ethicists to try to put the pieces of this puzzle together and make a new sexual morality that everyone can feel comfortable with. And I think we all have to make and put a part in putting that together.
Okay?
I think, though, we're
Father Gregory.
I would say that there is a moral crisis. First of all, I think, Rabbi, he did, on the Arsenio Hall show, come out four square that condoms was the way to go. You know, if I had my druthers, a person of Magic Johnson's magnitude, who has the type of influence that he does on young people, he had a wonderful opportunity to say to young people, look how I have destroyed my career, look how I have destroyed my life. Don't make the same mistakes that I have done by being promiscuous, but, you know, have a proper respect for the gift of human sexuality, and wait. It's worth waiting, because life is worth living.
I think that he was right in saying use condoms now. It's almost like seeing someone drowning in a lake and throwing a life preserver. He said, let me save your lives now, and we can get into that debate a little bit later, because if he goes around the country only talking about condoms, I think his mission will fail. But if he goes down around the country speaking of the quality of life that one can live, whether one is sick or one isn't sick, I think that his mission will succeed. And I can't imagine somebody who has shown such brilliance on the basketball court, intellectual brilliance in what he's done, I can't imagine that man not showing the same kind of brilliance and the same kind of courage wherever he goes. So I think that we're going to see a lot out of Magic Johnson, and if there's any man in this country that's going to be able to change the way at least a new generation is thinking, I think he's the man. Let's wait for him.
Well, Rabbi, you wouldn't disagree with Father Gregory, though, would you, that the message about not abusing sexuality, not being promiscuous, is more basic? Now, you two are going to have a disagreement about condom use. We do as well, but isn't it more fundamental to talk about using sex properly in the moral sense? It's the promiscuity that it seems to me we should all agree should be hit
in
this matter.
There's a Hebrew proverb that says, "In tafasta meruba lo tafasta." It means, if you try to take too much, you'll get nothing at all. I think that Magic was right in trying to say, let's do this little bit right now, and after we finish doing this little bit, using condoms, we'll go on to the next portion, and we'll try to make and speak the kind of arguments that everyone here is speaking about. But I don't think he could say that right away, because if he said something that was too strong and no one listened to him, there would be no reason for him to talk at all.
I think they would have taken him seriously if he'd said it.
Well, where I still have to disagree with you, Rabbi, is I doubt the man's brilliance in this particular area, because what we will do is send to young people mixed signals. It would be like saying to a kid, don't drink and drive, but just in case you do, I put a six-pack in the trunk. And, you know, we're going to have this thing coming before the Los Angeles Unified School District board on giving out condoms to kids in junior and senior high school. I think, you know, these are the people who are going to try to draft Magic Johnson as their spokesperson, and it's going to be very, very difficult for those of us who don't believe that this is a proper signal to send to young people to come up against somebody who is now the object of adulation for having gotten sick. It's a moral crisis. I think Ron put the right words on it.
I have one more comment, and then we'll move to the next subject, and that's from Pastor Chapman here.
I think that Magic Johnson is a highly intelligent man, and I hope that he approaches this subject the same way he approached his basketball career. He made no bones about selecting the best of coaches, going to the best of teams, learning the best of skills, getting the best of experts to make him the best he could be. And now he's in a new field of new discussion that's entirely new to him. I just hope that as he enters that field, that he equally used that talent to bring to the forefront people who have expertise in the area that can give him the proper advice so he can be the proper kind of spokesman that he can be. That's what I hope and pray happens.
Okay. Well, let's move to another topic. This is KABC Los Angeles. Thank you, Ron.
And you're listening to Religion on the Line. I'm Ira Fussell, filling in for Dennis Prager tonight with a panel of four clergy. Let's go to line 13. Bob, you're on the air.
Hi, I have two questions for Rabbi Kriegel and you, Ira. First, where do you see the major theological differences existing between the conservative and reformed denominations in 30 years?
Okay, well, I'm going to let the rabbi handle this. That's his business. Go ahead.
I think that the major differences that existed 30 years ago are the same differences that will exist in 30 years. Conservative Judaism looks at tradition and says we accept all of tradition, and if we find something that's not correct, we'll try to reinterpret it. Reformed Judaism started out by saying there's some traditions, such as the Code of Jewish Laws, that we don't accept, but we're willing, after rejecting it, to look at those traditions and perhaps come back and embrace some of those traditions to make our lives more meaningful. So I think the differences are found in those two in that theory. In practice, I think among the lay people, the basis of belief and practice is getting closer together. And among the rabbis, I think that conservative rabbis tend to have a practice that's closer to Orthodox tradition, and Reform rabbis tend to have a practice that's farther away from Orthodox tradition.
You don't see the branches moving closer then?
I think in practice they're moving closer.
Yeah.
But still, one begins with a rejection of tradition, and one begins with an acceptance of tradition. As time goes on, that acceptance of tradition gets pared down by some laws that we don't think are useful.
Things they need to, that such the demand reinterpretation.
Such as driving to synagogue on Saturday. And as time goes on, I think the Reform movement sees that there's some tradition that they might have thrown out that would be good to embrace again. And in that way, they're getting closer.
Yes.
Okay.
And my second question is, for the rabbi alone, do you think that in the conservative denomination, A, that women should be allowed to become rabbis, and B, that patrilineal children of Jews should be recognized as Jews?
I think that women should be able to be rabbis. One of the great movements that makes conservative Judaism different than Orthodox is this concept of egalitarianism. We believe that all people are equal. We also believe that all Jews have equal rights. That means a Jewish woman can do what a Jewish man can do, and a Jewish man can do what a Jewish woman can do. Consequently, we have no argument that women, many of us have no argument that women can become rabbis. Although there are those who believe that patrilineal descent has an ancient history, and I've read that history, the major conservative concept has been to never stray so far from the body of Jewish opinion that we're in a cross schisms. If we permitted patrilineal descent, that would mean if a man's father, a woman's father is Jewish, but their mother isn't Jewish, and we defined that child as Jewish, we would end by having the Orthodox communities not recognize us as Jews at all. And the conservative movement believes in what's known as Catholic Israel, as defined by Solomon Schechter, which means that we're all one brotherhood, we're all one peoplehood, and we're not trying to cause schisms that will separate us. And
of course, the Reform movement has accepted patrilineal descent, which puts it at odds with the Orthodox movements on a very fundamental question of who is a Jew.
And that's a very difficult issue. When a Reform child wants to get married to a conservative child, and there's been a patrilineal definition of Judaism for the Reformed child, in many cases that child will have to convert even to marry a conservative
Orthodox.
Can the conservative denomination then come up with a better idea to combat intermarriage?
Well, I think the best idea that we have is the product that we're selling, is the tradition that we're selling, is the history, is our approach to God and approach to mankind. And maybe we're not doing as good a job as we should do it. But I think that what we have is found in the Bible, in the Torah, is found in the Talmud, and is found in many of the teachings. That's the best we have, and it's wonderful.
The idea being that if people really knew what they had, they wouldn't throw it away quite so easily.
Right.
Okay.
Could I throw in another definition of who is a Jew?
Okay. This is Dr. Bonson.
In Romans, the second chapter, the Apostle Paul says, "For he is not a Jew who is one outwardly, neither is that circumcision which is outward in the flesh, but he is a Jew who is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, not in the letter, whose praise is not of men, but of God. And what you have here is a different approach to Jewishness that defines it in walking after the faithfulness of Abraham rather than after the biological.
That's kind of a Christian definition.
Exactly.
Right. Jews have never accepted that, and one could never be defined as a Jew by reading anything in Romans, no matter what it says.
Well, I think Paul's Jewish credentials are impeccable. And so his theology, I think it's another voice that needs to be taken into account.
Well, I think Paul's Jewish credentials were impeccable until he became a Christian.
Until he became, Paul, right.
Then he was no longer a Jew.
Except that after he became a Christian, he said that he still was Jew of Jews.
I think, though, that Paul's using the term Jew there in a very different sense than in terms of speaking of still being attached to the Jewish faith and the Jewish people in the sense that the rabbi's been talking about. I think Paul's talking here about the spiritual peoplehood of the people who are the followers of Jesus, the disciples of Jesus, and he's talking about a new people of God, as we talk about New Israel, Old Israel, New Testament, Old Testament, and so forth.
But he doesn't see himself cut off from the Jewish history because he talks about not all Israel is Israel. He does believe that the true expression of Jewishness is in affirming the Messiah, and then believes that because true Judaism is one of faith, that opens the door to others to be seed of Abraham who are not biological.
Okay. But that's exactly the point at which he differs from Jewish theology.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah, I think he differs in two ways. One, he differs because Jews don't accept the Christian Messiah. And secondly, he differs even from Jesus, who in Sermon on the Mount, I think in the 5th chapter of Matthew, says, do not change a jot or tittle of the law. Jot meaning a yud, the smallest Hebrew letter, and a tittle meaning a tag, a little part of a letter that's found on a letter called a shin.
Is that what jot and tittle comes from? I never knew that.
It's the dogish and resh. It's the extension that goes beyond the horizontal line.
It's not a dagesh. There was no dagesh.
Let me recommend my book, Theonomy and Christian Ethics, goes into that at great length. That's right. We aren't to change a jot or a tittle of the law. Only the lawgiver can tell us what that means.
All right, I think we've answered the question. Pastor Chapman.
It's interesting that we just had in our Sunday school lesson that very same discussion where Paul is being ostracized from the synagogue because they felt he wasn't a good Jew. And in order to save face, his friends ask him to help these four men who are concluding their Nazarite vows, and Paul does that, but they still chase him out of the synagogue.
Well, I think
in Acts 21, we discussed this.
Okay, so I think we've covered this subject, so let's move.
Well, can I just have one more word? I think what it really boils down to is that you have to allow each group to identify itself and who belongs to that group. Mm-hmm. This is why there's this constant thing going on with Jews for Jesus, who are Christians.
Yeah.
And Jews take great umbrage at themselves calling themselves Jews for Jesus.
Right. Yes. Let's go to our next call here. Greg in North Hollywood, you're on with the panel, and I'm RFSO for Dennis Prager.
Hi there. In the beginning of the show, what was with all that coughing?
That was me.
That was you. Okay, my phone had a flu. Anyway.
No, that was me and my residue of my pneumonia from 3 weeks ago.
Oh, that. Feeling better?
Oh, yeah, I'm fine. I mean, it's just every once in a while I have one of those coughing fits.
Okay, don't leave the air like that again. I mean, you're supposed to be there.
Well, I'm here, so go ahead.
Good. Question for everybody. If an atheist, which for the record is not me, if an atheist came up to you and said, point to something that would prove the existence of God, what would it be? And I don't mean the Bible.
Okay, let's see what the clergy say about this. Let's start with Father Gregory.
Well, I think the first thing I would say to the atheist is the existence of God cannot be proven, and if God's existence could be proven, then you wouldn't be free to be an atheist. So therefore, God, because he made you human, gave you the freedom to either come to know him or not to come to know him. But I think that there's enough evidence for God's existence to be convincing. Look at creation. Creation implies a creator. I like Dennis's argument about the moral necessity for God. If there is no God, then kicking rocks and kicking children are morally equivalent. Everything becomes opinion. So I think that there are arguments that are persuasive, but in the final analysis, it cannot be proven, nor can the atheist disprove it.
Exactly. I mean, that's one of the ways you could turn around and show me evidence that he doesn't exist.
All right.
Yeah. Rabbi?
Hi, Greg. How are you?
Hi there. How you doing?
Okay. Greg is my congregant. God's presence can
be found. I find God's presence in my relationship with God. I find that relationship when I pray to God. But of course, that's very subjective, and I can't prove to an atheist that which I feel. I find God's presence in the acts of good people, but then again, that's subjective, and I can't prove to someone else that which I recognize.
Isn't it by definition an atheist one who disbelieves in God? Therefore, you can't prove the existence of an atheist because he will not accept whatever proof you offer. By definition, he won't accept.
Right, but I could tell an atheist where I find God, right. Even though an atheist will probably refuse to recognize that place where I find God.
Pastor Chapman.
I would ask the atheist to tell me, what does he mean when he says define God? What is he saying?
No, not define. But, you know, if there's something in this world or in the universe, whatever, which is so fabulous,
yes,
that there has to be a God. I don't mean in terms...
Is he going to say the word God?
I'm sorry?
Is he going to say the word God? If the atheist is asking me to point out to him or prove that there is a God, and if he said the word God, I'd ask him to tell me what he meant.
Okay, prove the existence of a...
You didn't hear me.
Well...
If he said the word God, I'd ask him to tell me what he meant. And if he can tell me what he meant, then I don't have to answer his question.
Okay, I see what you're getting at.
Let me redefine my question as far as...
I think that... See, that's the answer. That's the answer, that if he cannot define what God is, then you have to answer the question. And if he can define it, it doesn't mean you don't have to answer the question.
Right. Yeah.
That is the answer in itself contained. Okay, Dr. Boxer.
That's all right.
I almost said father, but I know it's not.
No, I'm not.
Pastor, it'd be better.
I am a father, but not in the way that
not
he's
that
a father.
Not that one.
If an atheist asked me to point to something that would prove the existence of God, I would encourage him to choose anything he wants at all to point to, because everything in this world proves the existence of God. The way in which it proves the existence of God, and remember, there is a difference between proof and persuasion. Proof, it has objective standards. Persuasion is subjective. You can lead a horse to water, you can't make him drink. I mean, it may be there, the proof may be there, but that doesn't mean that his heart has changed. You know, a man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still, that sort of thing. So not dealing with the subjective question of changing the person's heart, objectively, there's sufficient proof for God's existence and everything. In fact, the very fact that the atheist wants to use reason, he wants to be rational, is a proof of God's existence, because if there were no God, there would be no standards of rationality. There would just be the way these rocks and streams and trees are, you know, carrying on, as well as this biological accident called man. And there'd be no reason for that biological accident to trust anything that's going on in his brain tissue and so forth. When an atheist wants to use reason, that in and of itself shows that he knows that he's the image of God and he is to use rationality. The Apostle Paul in Romans 1 tells us that God is clearly known through the created order, that everything in the creation bears testimony to him. And I find it interesting that Paul says that God has done this in such a way that men are without excuse for not believing in him. He doesn't think that there's some kind of vague testimony that if you want to make a leap of faith, then that sort of thing. He says, no, that it is a violation of your rationality not to believe in God.
Okay.
All right.
May I add one more thing to that one? Rabbi, go ahead.
There's a wonderful Hasidic story that says this is the lowest of all universes that God could have created for and have God recognized. For in this universe, everything either proves or disproves the existence of God, but if it was one step lower, it would disprove the existence of God.
And I'm going to just say one thing. I can't prove, and I don't say this, and I just asked me to prove the existence of God. I couldn't prove the existence of God, but I can point to something, many things, but one in particular, which I think is a miracle, and that is every time a human baby is born. I mean, what more miraculous thing in the world is there than a human baby? There's no way you can possibly come up with anything so miraculous as a baby.
I guess yours is the best is... what I was expecting, I mean, I got, I have to admit I was somewhat disappointed because I got the responses trying to define God or rational answers. See, I was looking for pretty much what you said, you know, pointing to a baby and say, there you go. While it doesn't automatically, logically follow that there's a God, it is a good, intuitive proof that it just couldn't be otherwise.
Well, it certainly would be an amazing thing if babies, as Father said before, Father Gregory said before, if there could be a creation without a creator.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody, I think, could argue that a baby is not a miraculous creation.
Babies are wonderful things, but I really would have to take difference with the idea of an intuitive proof. People intuit a lot of things which we don't want to consider.
Remember what I said. I said, I can't prove it. I can't prove it. This proves it.
No.
God, but to me,
the caller used that expression, not you.
Okay. Thank you. You're listening to Religion on the Line. It's 16 minutes past 11 o'clock, and this is Talk Radio 790 KABC, and I'm Ira Fistel. Our panel tonight includes Pastor Dudley Chapman, First Vice President of the Western States Baptist Convention, Rabbi Aaron Kriegel, Conservative Congregation in Reseda, Father Gregory Quiro of the Archdiocese, Roman Catholic Priest, and Dr. Greg Bronson, Presbyterian Minister in Southern California Center for Christian Studies at Irvine. Let's go right to our next caller at 1-800-222-KABC. Buonasera, Italia.
Oh, gioia mia. I hope your cold gets better.
I don't have a cold.
Well, your cough.
Anyway, go ahead.
Well, I'd like to speak to all of them, Father Quiro, Dr. Bronson, Rabbi Kriegel, and Reverend Chapman. Now, the thing that I wanted to call about was that I think it's so unfair for all of us to bash one another, whether it be Catholic, Jewish, Baptist, Lutheran, Protestant, it matters not.
I haven't heard much bashing tonight.
A little. See what I mean. People are kind of fickle, and often they change from one religion to another, and that's because they're human and they're looking for something idealistic instead of something spiritualistic. Now, polarization of religious groups is acceptable, I think. However, I think spiritual union is a must because God loves us all, whether we like that or not. He doesn't just pick and choose. You know, God doesn't say yes and then say no, I don't think. Now, I think this show expels ignorance, and it leads to an understanding and an acceptance. And so let me, if you have time, just explain as a Catholic how I relate to Mary. Not worship her. I respect her because she was the mother of Jesus, and I love Jesus with all my heart. Now, I'm not going to say Jesus was God or anything like that. I'm just going to say I love Jesus with all my heart because Jesus was a wonderful person. And I keep a picture of Mary and Jesus and Joseph on my piano. And as I'm bringing up my children, I can never thank their spirits enough for helping me to bring up my children, to look upon the faces of these people who were so wonderful examples for all of us. Was just such a the burst of my spirit when my patience waned, and when I looked at the flowers that the children put at her spot on the piano, or a leaf grown red with the sun, or a magic apple seed, as they said, or a small handwritten request stuck in the hollow bottom of her, or a sleeping child with a rosary in her hand, this added to God's blessings for me. And that's what it's all about. I think that God blesses us in many ways, and some of these people who have gone before us have set such examples. Mary was a human being. She wasn't a god, and I love her. But now, by the same token, there was a fellow by the name of St. Jude, who is the patron saint of hopeless cases. Now, heaven help you, children, when I played musical holy cards, and if you found St. Jude's card by your picture, I didn't have to say a word. You see, it's the essence of it that's so important, and that's what I had to say, the spiritual union that all of us must have. And if you think it's a miracle, dear brother and sister out there, it's a miracle.
I think that's kind of the reason why we have a Religion on the Line program, changing the kind of basic things on which we do agree on, as well as
right.
The various religions disagree. But I haven't heard anybody bashing anybody tonight, really.
Well, they kind of bashed, in the beginning about the Virgin Mary. Yes.
Well, it depends on what you define as bashing, I guess.
That was a little...
Yeah, it's Father Gregory.
This is Father Gregory. I wouldn't consider it bashing when people of differing opinions will come together and discuss where they differ.
Yes.
Believe me, I know Catholic bashing, and I've dealt with it. And believe me, there's no bashing going on here tonight. It's people having honest disagreements.
Well, maybe I took it a little personally because I love Mary.
Okay. Grazie, Italia.
Yes, bye-bye.
Buonanotte. All right, it's now 20 minutes past 11 o'clock on 790 KABC Talk Radio, and this is Religion on the Line. Dennis is taking the night off. I'm Ira Fistel filling in for him. And let's continue with Scott in Long Beach. Hi, Scott.
All right, how you doing?
Good.
How'd your seminar do tonight?
Well, it went very well, I think.
Great. I'm going to try to catch you next time.
I really feel it. I think it went really well. We'll talk about it tomorrow night. Go ahead.
Okay, great. Quick comment about magic, then I have a question for the rabbi and the rest of the clergy also. Because we don't live in a perfect world, I think magic might have two responsibilities. One, is to promote abstinence, which is the ultimate, and two, if the kids or whoever he talks to can't hold up the abstinence, that they should use a condom, because he's not part of the clergy, and he's not part of the moral things. He doesn't represent the clergy, so I think he should speak for both issues, because we don't live in an imperfect world.
And then should he take responsibility if somebody gets AIDS, even though they used a condom?
Well, he shouldn't take responsibility, but he's got a responsibility to... If kids are going to have sex, I guess it's Father Gregory?
Yes.
Kids are going to have sex, Father. I mean, that's unfortunately, but that's what's going to happen.
But, you know, that's such a red herring, because I hear this all the time. You know, people are going to commit murder, so why don't we legalize murder? People are going to steal, so why don't we legalize stealing? Why don't we remove the moral stigma that these things are ugly and wrong? You know, it's the same thing. Yes, people will do what people do because people are human and they will commit failings. But that doesn't mean that we as a society are going to put our good housekeeping seal of approval on it.
Oh, I agree with that and the premise of it. Again, we don't live in a perfect world and we have to cover our bases. And kids need all the help they can to prevent our kids, being 30-year-olds even, to remember to have use, if they're going to have sex, to use a condom. I mean, it's just going to happen. I agree with what you're saying from a premise point, but I just don't think it's going to happen.
Now, you wanted to make another point.
Yeah, I have a question for the rabbi and then the rest of the clergy. Rabbi, I have a question concerning, in a sense, money and when friends owe you money. And how does the church or the temple, how do they feel about handling that? Should a friendship be broken, or not broken, but if there's a problem collecting money or something like that, in that nature, from friends who are people who are good to you in the usual sense and who've been close to you, but money seems to become a problem.
In other words, somebody, for example, you lend money to a friend and the friend doesn't get around to repaying it.
And doesn't pay it, or the business, in our own business and friendship. My problem is a personal thing right now, but I've seen it in other families where money breaks up the friendship. And I've been struggling with this issue.
Okay, let's have the rabbi say what he has to say.
Well, in Tractate Shabbos, in the Talmud, it says that the first question that God asks people when they come to the world to come, they're going to be accepted in the world to come, is, were you fair in business? So actually, being fair in business and giving money that's owed promptly is a cardinal virtue in Judaism. Judaism doesn't begin with only the very difficult questions, but the very common questions, and that's one of them. People can't live together unless on issues such as business they can have the same moral schedule, and I think that if you have a friend, as an example, who doesn't hold true to a commitment he has to you, that person is showing himself to be not much of a friend, as evidenced by the story that I gave in the beginning.
So the answer is, if it breaks up the friendship...
There was no friendship.
There was no friendship to break up in the first place.
Right. This is an interesting question as a follow-up to what went on before between the caller and Father Gregory. And
this is Dr. Botchins.
Yeah. And I share Father Gregory's concern that we say, well, they're going to do it anyway, and so, you know, let's live in the real world and so forth. It's for the real world that God laid down his laws, you know, to help us deal with the problems we get into. But now, why wouldn't we turn this around? I'm saying this to the caller, and say it to you too. Look, hey, in the real world, people are going to stiff you on loans. Why does that bother you? Why don't you just learn to live with that? That's the real world.
Well, that's why I'm calling and finding out what the religious say about it, because I don't want to lose my friendship over money. That's why I was concerned too with how the religious anyone went over it.
Question: would you rather lose the money and keep the friendship? Is that a friendship that's worth keeping?
Well,
I think that's the rabbi's point.
Right. I've come to the decision that I'd rather keep the friendship, but other people have told me otherwise, and I wanted to get a religious aspect from it.
Well, the question is the friendship worth it if you're dealing with someone who's essentially being dishonest to you?
Right.
In a Christian perspective, we can forgive our friends for their faults. I mean, and if that's what you're saying, is that you forgive this person for not living up to his obligation, that's certainly your freedom to do that. And if someone else comes along and tells you, well, no, you shouldn't forgive this person, then I think they're intruding in a place that they don't belong. They have no right to tell you whether you can be a forgiving friend to somebody or not.
Okay, now, does that muddy the waters or clarify the situation for you?
Well, it muddies the waters a little bit.
That's what I thought.
It's a tough situation, but the reason I brought this up is not only in a personal, but I've noticed families have had problems with this issue, and I think it's a problem that maybe, it's a bigger problem than people are aware of, money interrupting people's lives.
This is not about money, but may I bring up an incident that happened to my daughter, Samantha, the other day, which I think is very interesting because of the way she handled it. She was supposed to go to a girl's house, and when it's time to go, the girl said, you weren't invited, I didn't invite you, and she invited her best friend instead. And Samantha came home, and she's at the front door. She's crying, you know, that she felt so bad about it because this girl had definitely invited her the day before and then changed her mind and invited her best friend instead. A real slap in the face. And, you know, after we talked for a while, she said something that I thought was really profound. She said, well, I realize now that this girl is not really a close friend of mine. She's not really reliable if she would do something like that. And while I can accept her as a casual friend, I can't really trust her. And that really is the situation you're in.
Mm, that's right. Well, tough decisions, but that's life.
Okay.
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
How old is Samantha?
10.
Well, really, it would qualify for out of the mouths of babes.
I thought that was pretty profound on her part, to realize that and be able to put it in perspective that way. It's 27 minutes after 11 o'clock on 790 KABC Talk Radio, 1-800-222-5222. Lynn in Los Angeles, you're on the air.
Hi, Ira, and the panel.
You're on with the panel.
Okay, I'd just like to make maybe three brief points on, I believe it was the priest who commented on Magic Johnson saying that what he should have said the day after. One of the things I believe the father said was he should have said, don't do as I do and be promiscuous. I don't think we can assume that Magic was promiscuous. I think we need to be educated enough to know about any sexually transmitted diseases that you don't have to be promiscuous to acquire it. It could have been one occasion where he forgot to use a condom. We don't know if he had one partner, and maybe that partner had it. We just don't know. So I think we need to be careful classifying him as being promiscuous.
Okay, I don't think he ever used the word promiscuity, did he?
The priest did.
Oh, no, I mean Magic did.
Somebody on that panel. No,
Magic
did. That's what I'm saying.
Well,
Magic did not say he was promiscuous, and that's why.
I think I did use the word, and I think promiscuous is a relative term. What one person considers promiscuous, perhaps another person would not.
Well,
but I'm also going on what's been reported over the last few days, since this has really dominated the news, is that all these sports stars are having sex thrust at them, and many of them are promiscuous. And now, if I've been an injustice to Magic Johnson, I apologize.
Well, I think you did, because you were saying what you thought he should have said, him specifically. And I think we need to be careful not to...
But in any case, you know, let me amend that. You know, what he should have said is, you know, I was wrong, you know, which I haven't heard him say yet, but I was wrong to abuse the gift of sexuality by not waiting for marriage.
Father, I don't think that we can say what he should have said.
I'm coming from a particular perspective,
okay.
And I think I can say that.
Okay,
thank you.
May I say what I just wanted to bring up my few brief points, because I only have a short time. I'm grateful that he didn't wait, because I think by coming on the next day, the very next day after he found out, it showed great moral courage. He didn't wallow in self-pity. He came forward and said, I'm going to do something about this. And I think he saved many lives by doing it. And I think that he's realistic enough to know, as he said on Arsenio Hall, if you're going to do this, protect yourself. And I'm grateful for him for saying it, because I think a lot of people would be better off if it had been said by someone like him before. So that's all that I wanted to say, and thank you.
All right. Thank you for your call, Lynn.
Bye.
You're listening to Religion on the Line. Lewis in North Hollywood, you're on the air.
Good evening, Ira, and members of the panel. First of all, I'd like to put the sacredness of the Temple Mount in proper perspective. It has been sacred in the secular sense to the Jewish people for about 3.5 millennia, occurring in two stages. First of all, the city of Jerusalem was established by King David as a means of unifying the Hebrew tribes into a nation, very effectively, it seems. And second stage...
Yeah, he established the capital there. He actually conquered
it
in the first...
Right, created as to be a capital for the nation, and in so doing, unified tribes into a nation.
Actually, it was Hezekiah who did that well before... Go on.
As I remember my history...
Well, David was the one who conquered Jerusalem in the first place.
And established the capital there.
Has the Hezekiah put together the Deuteronomy and with the whole purpose of making that.
But then he was much later, wasn't he? Hezekiah was many, many generations later than David.
Yes, he improved the defenses of the city, notably by bringing water.
But I think this is a point that doesn't need to be elaborated. Go ahead.
The second point is that Solomon built the temple there, which was rebuilt after its destruction by Ezra and Nehemiah, again, as a focal point and a symbol for unification of the people, as well as for religious practice. Also as a repository of the best of Jewish culture at that time. Religion at that time being used a term to encompass all of culture. Now, so that is why this place has been sacred, I say, in the secular sense to the Jewish nation for 3.5 millennia. I don't know what business Muhammad had there. He was pretty far from home, if he actually did visit the city. I don't know about that. But anybody can make up a tale of a miracle that supposedly happened there. We have no control over Islamic miracles.
Lewis, are you being fair to Islam? After all, doesn't Islam have the right to the same kind of stories and characters as any other religion?
I'll give you a simile. Suppose that after burning our capital, the British had decided that a miracle occurred there, and they're going to build a temple or, let's say, a church or a cathedral in commemoration of that. Of course, within the Church of England, and therefore that city is now sacred to the Church of England, and America has no right to it.
If it was, would that be any difference in saying that an American would say it's our capital and it's not sacred to you? How would you have the right to say what was sacred to somebody else?
I say you can say you can make it sacred if you feel like, but what business have you there in our capital?
Because it's sacred to them. They have just as much business as you have. How can you argue that one side can determine what's sacred to somebody else?
They can determine that it's sacred to them if they want to say so, but can't determine that they have a right.
You have, all right, by the same token, I'm going to pick up this argument. Supposedly, by that argument, you could say that, if, for example, the Jewish people in Israel could say, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre may be sacred to Christians, but they have no right here. It's not their country. That's the same kind of thinking, and it's just as crazy. Anybody going to pick me up on this?
And if I can think of an analogous situation, we had this unfortunate incident in Auschwitz, where different people had different ideas of how to commemorate what went on there, and it caused a terrible rift between the Catholic and Jewish communities, and luckily, fortunately, has now been resolved, and the nuns will be moving.